Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It's very nice to have you with us on this Wednesday, the 4th of September. And, school starts for most kids tomorrow, right? Does that seem to be correct from the two parents in the room?
In the Capital District, that's right.
Yeah, and not that you're not a parent, Bob, but of younger children who would be
yes,
going on to
yes,
the school bus.
Yes, older.
Yes. And are your kids old enough to go to school or no?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thankfully, yes.
Okay, good. So,
it's the most happiest time of the year.
We love that ad. Yes. Staples did that a couple years ago. Well, anyway, so that's happening tomorrow, but today, I was still like, I wonder if it'll take a long time to get in or not, but it was nice and the roads were normal, and so here we are. I hope you all had a pleasant evening, and we welcome you this morning. We have a lot to talk about, a lot going on, just some interesting stories, some just really weird. But that's not different for us, and we'll get started in just a moment. Let me introduce the group to you. They're raring to go, and we welcome you too. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, if you would like. In on our discussion, we welcome Sarah Rogerson, who is in the building, Albany Law School professor, director of the Justice Center. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
Excellent.
Happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday to you. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Joe. Happy early fall to everybody. Boy, the seasons are certainly changing. So watch the school buses, everybody.
Watch the school buses. That's right. Pack the have the sweatshirt in the car just in case.
Yep.
It's that that time of year.
This area is so gorgeous in the fall, though. So
oh,
enjoy.
It's perfect. Yeah, and the trees are starting to change, so it's very cool. It's a nice, beautiful time of the year. J.P. Miller is here, the man behind the Empire Report. Busy times for that publication, or what do you call it? A publication. You publish it in your own way.
It's a website.
Yeah.
But yes, it's a busy time,
it's a website, Joe.
it's a busy time and interesting news coming out yesterday for sure.
Well, certainly, absolutely. Let's get to that right away. Again, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So, and if I have, here we go. As soon as the New York Times identifies my credentials, I will be. There we go.
I hate
okay.
it when that happens.
Yes, it's just like oh, we know you're here all the time, but who are you? Linda Sun, who worked for is it Sun? Linda Sun, who worked for both Governor Kathy Hochul and Governor Andrew Cuomo, was accused of using her position to benefit the Chinese government. So, a New York official charged with taking money, travel, and poultry to aid China. This is a fascinating story that is complicated. And is just strange, but Ms. Sun was charged on Tuesday with 10 criminal counts that included visa fraud, money laundering, and other crimes. Her husband, Chris Hu, who is 41 years old, a businessman, is charged in the indictment with money laundering. Both pleaded not guilty in federal court, were released on bond, and were required to surrender their passports. Brian Peace, the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York, who oversaw the investigation with the FBI, said in a statement that Ms. Sun betrayed the public trust. While appearing to serve the people of New York as deputy chief of staff within the New York State Executive Chamber, the defendant and her husband actually worked to further the interests of the Chinese government and the CCP. Linda Sun's lawyer, Gerald Schaefer, said that Ms. Sun was looking forward to addressing the indictment in court. Our client is understandably upset that these charges have been brought. The accusations, if true, would represent a brazen manipulation of New York State government at the highest level, covering several years of the administrations of Ms. Hochul and Andrew Cuomo, both Democrats. The press secretary for Ms. Hochul said that Ms. Sun was hired by the executive chamber more than a decade ago, adding that the Hochul administration officials immediately reported her actions to law enforcement and have assisted law enforcement throughout the process. He said that the administration terminated her employment in March of 2023 after discovering evidence of misconduct. JP.
Yeah, thank you, Joe. You know, anytime there are federal charges brought against a top staffer for the governor of New York or the mayor, it's big news. The newspapers today talk about a brand new Ferrari, a condo in Hawaii, and a $3.6 million Long Island home and lavish spending. From what I read, government officials are required to fill out financial disclosure forms. And Ms. Sun's financial disclosure form showed her government salary and then that her husband did not make any meaningful money, you know, according to that financial disclosure form. The government is alleging that that financial disclosure form is wrong, that they were making millions of dollars. The alleged scheme says basically that Ms. Sun boosted the Chinese government within New York's government apparatus, and in exchange that the Chinese government or officials helped set her husband up with a business exporting lobsters to China. And, you know, the big money did not appear on the disclosure forms. The big money that they allegedly received also did not appear on their tax forms. I guess they didn't pay taxes on this money. What I had a hard time reading, though, is usually when you read about a corruption scandal in New York, it's so-and-so gets paid in exchange for taxpayer dollars from the state or official actions. And New York State doesn't really have much domain over the relationship with China. You know, our federal government has domain over that. I also thought it was interesting that there is a Taiwanese official named Senator John Liu who came to the defense of Linda Sun. And, you know, they allege that she was basically, you know, taking out references to Taiwan in speeches, et cetera. And that Senator Liu says that, you know, she is innocent until proven guilty. There are examples of other prosecutions against Asian Americans where the government does not quite grasp the cultural, how their culture works, and then those charges are dropped. That's what Senator Liu, a well-thought-of senator, I thought it was interesting that he jumped to her defense and said there's nothing here.
Prosecutors say that Ms. Sun blocked Taiwanese officials from having access to the governor's office, eliminated references to Taiwan from state communications, and quashed meetings between Taiwanese officials and state leaders, including Governor Kathy Hochul, who succeeded Mr. Cuomo and who promoted Ms. Sun to deputy chief of staff. Sarah.
Yeah, I thought actually the Empire Report headline was grabby as well. Hochul furious, I think, was the headline. I always get the Empire Report because
thank you
because what happens in New York is actually a really big deal across the country, right? So we're in really close proximity to one of the major news publications. No offense to anyone here, but the New York Times, right? So people all over the country read that. So we forget, I think, sometimes being so New York-centric, how important our state is and how important what our officials and their chiefs of staff, deputy chiefs of staff say. So it's a problem not just for Hochul, obviously, but it casts a cloud over the Cuomo administration. Grace Meng, who has been stellar by all accounts, and so it's an uncomfortable story for Democrats period, at a really crappy time for that kind of a story to come out. That, you know, somebody was getting paid taxpayer dollars to find more taxpayer dollars for personal enrichment. So it's it also it's on the heels of the Bob Menendez gold bars story. It's just like we usually think of these things coming out of New Jersey. No offense to New Jersey. It's just we've come to expect
that. There goes our ratings in New Jersey. Yeah.
None taken.
No. I just, you know, like,
this is so Jersey.
This is really Jersey of us. And maybe it's a downstate thing. I'm just going to irritate everybody this morning. But, you know, I just...
But it wasn't gold bars. It was ducks.
And a Ferrari and shell companies.
Yes.
And the Taiwanese angle is interesting because she seemed to be interfering with Taiwanese access. So it's just, there's more under this story. I'm sure there's more.
I'm sure.
We'll see more headlines and hopefully not before November.
Bob Griffin, I want to get your thoughts on this story in general. But one of the things that I thought of that I really wanted to ask you specifically is, so you have the administration, the Cuomo administration. This woman had been a part of that administration. Then there's a change in leadership between Governor Cuomo to Governor Hochul. Is there not then another opportunity to check the references and to go back and to see who exactly is being inherited in the switch here?
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine there's a whole vetting process, especially in the chamber, and I think this is one of the reasons the governor came out so strongly, because it failed, but at the same time, it's created a great deal of egg on her face, if we could continue with sort of the poultry jokes. For those of you that haven't read the article, it was the New York Times article. One of the first things that jumped out at me was the use of the private chef at the from the Chinese consulate was sending salted duck to the family. I'm going to take it a slightly different place, though. I think the quid pro quo here, if there is one, and again, it's a presumption of innocence, so I just want to make sure I start with that. Is the denial of access to Taiwan and Taiwanese leaders to New York, New York State, and by proxy, that creates, in my mind, a barrier to trade, a barrier particularly to the financial markets, and more importantly, at the national security level, it's another example of the growing manipulation of China of our critical infrastructures. The idea, and you get to realize how sophisticated the Chinese manipulation is. You know, you start to think about social media. You start to think about actually Chinese government's presence in neighborhoods and communities in New York City and in New York State. We see in this charge, it goes all the way up to access into the governor's office. The Chinese influence on in the soft powers are a growing threat to our national security. So I see this as an area to watch for the foreseeable future, as China tries to influence how we as a country feel and think, and if they can deny Taiwan access to it certainly helps their position.
And things like letterhead and proclamations, those aren't little things. Those are official government acts.
Given what you just said, Bob, about what we know of the Chinese government, if you are the governor of the other 49 states, what are you doing right now?
I'm going back and I'm asking for a review of everybody's ethics statements. You know, I actually think it's always a good thing. And I've said on the show in the past, Joe, I think that the state ethics rules continue to need a substantive rewrite, refresh, and strengthening.
What ethics rule law would have changed this, in fact, caught this?
Well, technically, I would argue that it was caught because, you know, of the charges. If you're filing an ethics, there's got to be some cross reference that makes some common sense, right? If I'm filing an ethics statement saying all I make is the salary that I get from my tax dollars, I don't have other sources of income or money. But I'm buying I think it was a $3.5 million house on Long Island, a condo in Honolulu. I'm driving a Ferrari. That should trigger something, okay? And in my mind, that there's an opportunity to think about how we could sort of cross-reference some of those issues. And a lot of times, there may be something that is completely innocent. You know, if you've inherited something from your family, or you know, some rationale. But there's got to be a connection between what you file and the state of reality in our ethics rules.
I have one more follow-up question, but we don't have time for it. So we'll take a quick break. Sure. When we come back, we'll reconvene and continue on this subject. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. Sarah Rogerson, Bob Griffin, and J.P. Miller making up our group this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. The subject we begin with and we continue with is a New York official charged with taking money, travel, and poultry to aid China. Linda Sun, who worked for both Governor Kathy Hochul and Governor Andrew Cuomo, was accused of using her position to benefit the Chinese government. Bob, one other follow-up I had before the break that I wanted to ask you before we break out into individual discussion groups is they had already parted ways. The governor and Linda Sun had already parted ways. In March of 2023, she left the administration.
Yes.
We also know from the governor's office that they worked, they reported and worked very diligently with law enforcement to give them any information that they had. So does it make sense that the story is coming out now as opposed to a year ago?
Yeah, because I think what you're dealing with was an ongoing investigation, and Justice finally felt that they had everything that they needed to move forward. The timing is interesting. Sarah, you raised the issue of sort of the specter of it being close to the election, so everything is highly politicized. I'll also note, I think it was over this weekend, there was another clash between Chinese Navy units in the Philippine Coast Guard. That I know our military was watching very closely, or at least that's the reports. I don't know that personally. It was just from open source intelligence. You also are seeing sort of a continued growing tension, Joe, with China flexing its muscles closer to the election. So you're seeing not just the tension with the Philippines, but with Vietnam. You're seeing tension with China and India. You're seeing an increase in cybersecurity poking attacks, testing systems. And of course, we know that disinformation is being used not only by China, but Russia and Iran and North Korea and others as we get closer and closer to the election. So this all sort of comes together at a time when the country, I think, is particularly vulnerable to the type of manipulation that she's being accused of.
I want to go back to something that was mentioned prior to the break, that Sun even arranged without proper authorization for Chinese government officials to receive official proclamations, formal framed documents that bear the state seal and the governor's signature. I think many of us know that we don't feel that they have much meaning or is all that special. I mean, they are, but they roll them out at a pretty good clip.
Mm-hmm.
But As stated here and as Bob mentioned, foreign officials hold them in extremely high esteem.
Right, and I know I keep going back to the little things, but this letterhead situation, I just in the Justice Center, students have to get a couple layers of approval before anything goes out on letterhead, and that's because we're closely supervising them under the limited supervised practice of law. I can't imagine that our office procedures are more strenuous than those in the governor's office, and that's part of the problem here is this specter of shady business at a time when the Democrats nationally are trying to set themselves apart from that sort of political corruption and behavior. It's deeply problematic, and it's a systemic issue with like some really simple solutions that don't need to go to the level of ethics revisions.
Bob?
I don't disagree. It's an interesting story because back to your point about this isn't sort of the classic, but in some respects it's very classic, right? I mean, it's a quid pro quo of money for influence. The difference though is that the influence is different. Joe, and this is just pure speculation, is that I said it was an ongoing investigation between time she was terminated to yesterday's event. When you start sort of wrapping in the international qualities and the international espionage qualities of it, there are cards that there are shoes that haven't dropped on this story yet. So I would think that there's more to the story that is going to come out.
Yeah, there's already emails that are in this news story, quotes from emails, which typically for these high-level investigations, a lot of that stuff is kept pretty secret. So if they're already out there, some how brazen this was, and I think Hochul's spokespeople were very wise to say, we can't believe how aggressively bad this was, although I don't think that sends the message that they think it does in terms of distancing themselves from culpability. But where there's a little bit, there's a lot.
Yeah, and I what was interesting too yesterday is seeing the interaction between Hochul's spokespeople and Governor Cuomo's spokespeople, where Hochul's spokespeople say, this person was hired 10 years ago under the previous administration. And the Cuomo spokesperson reminded folks that, yes, they were hired under the Cuomo administration, but you
promoted her
to deputy chief of staff. And so, I will say also that Governor Hochul has to be really happy that her administration terminated this person, and this wasn't a person that was, still hired by her or working in the government at the time of the FBI raid. I think the FBI raided their house about a month or two ago, and that didn't all happen while the person was still there, and that Hochul's office say that they alerted authorities to the. I don't see as much of a clear-cut corruption case in that what I think that the Suns are going to say is, look, Ms. Sun was promoted to a high level in New York State government, which we are really proud of, and her husband started a business exporting lobster, and that was a legitimate business. Now, they didn't pay taxes on it, so that's illegitimate, but it was not gold bars underneath the mattress like Bob Menendez had. The Linda Sun's husband, I guess, had a number of businesses, and those businesses became successful because of connections that were opened up through her work at the state government. I would say that I imagine there are a lot of people in state government, not necessarily that are connected to China, but that someone gets a job in state government and their spouse happens to have some ancillary business. I mean, it's exporting lobsters is about as far away from government as you can imagine, right? That the spouse of the
seems
government worker.
I don't know. Yeah. Lobsters are really political.
But having a business that happens to benefit because your spouse is now a top government official.
Well, I guess when you take a live creature and boil them, it's very political.
Well, there's a poem that I love that starts, "I woke up and it was political," right? Like everything's political,
right,
especially
yes.
like for the next 65 days or whatever. But I just forgot what I was going to say.
So I guess what I push back to Jerry is that to me it's almost a classic. Okay, it's not as gaudy as gold bars in the freezer. I think that might be hard to top, to be honest with you. But when you look at the reports out of from the New York Times, you're talking about family members being financially supported and politically supported back in China. You certainly see a level of spending. And while some of the connections may appear right now to be tenuous, this may be a situation where there is enough to prove felony acceptance of bribes, not paying taxes, money laundering, which is enough to put the full pressure of the legal system on them, which maybe then will be rolled into some sort of settlement agreement or you know, plead out or rolling on somebody else. So I think, you know, it'll be something to watch.
It's hard to make a lot of money in public service. It's hard to make sometimes.
Yeah, you're not buying a Ferrari.
Ferrari,
yeah.
No. And so sometimes, and there are a lot of situations where people choose that route because they have a spouse that can bring in the income that supports the lifestyle that they want. It's the business and government do at a certain point in the power hierarchy of government come to a crossroads, though. And so that's why we have these disclosure forms, to make sure that as you climb through the levers of power in any government, including county and hyper-local government, that there are checks on that access to power vis-a-vis your outside arrangements with your spouse or anybody else. Even board service can be challenging for nonprofits, because if they receive state funding, you know, it can complicate things. So that's why those guardrails are in place. And sometimes it's things like this that force those guardrails to narrow and really interfere with more effective government functions, which is really another sad downside of this, is that sometimes the layers of protection can get so thick. And some would argue in New York State that's the case, where there's so many ethical hoops to jump through that it actually impedes good government from happening. So it's about kind of like striking that balance. And this is one of those things that makes the pendulum swing towards the more conservative side of the spectrum.
And for people at home, just so you understand, when as a public official, I have to file an ethics statement, but it's about me and it's about my family. Okay. So, you know, so if you know, my wife is an incredibly successful academic. But if she was, you know, I don't know, a Bill Gates rich type person, you know, that I would have to be putting that, I would have to be showing that, I would have to be showing where the relationship with and the intent. And, you know, Sarah, you're right. Sometimes they narrow too much. But at the same time, the ability for people to understand if there's a bias, like if I have money in stock in a company, then I shouldn't be doing anything on behalf of the state that impacts or would affect that company. So I mean, there's it is a constant balance of what's too much, what's too invasive versus what's enough for the people to be able to understand if there is a perceived bias. And I know at the federal government, it in some respects, it was even stricter, that if you go into particularly the political positions at the higher level of government, you actually have to divest yourself, which is one of the reasons why a lot of people don't go into federal service at the higher levels, because they just simply can't afford to divest of all of their earnings.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We'll go to letters, and we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome you 10 minutes before 10 o'clock on this Wednesday morning, the 4th of September. We have been talking about Linda Sun, a former Hochul aide, a former Cuomo aide in New York State in the governor's office, charged as a Chinese agent. We welcome your letters on this topic. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Joanne makes this point. Seems as though the Democrats could reply to the Hochul aide firing by replacing the, by repeating the 2017 $10 million contribution to Trump's campaign by the Egyptian government. There's plenty of corruption to go around. As Alan Chartok used to say regularly on this program, two wrongs don't make a right.
Right.
I mean, it's still corruption.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right.
And it shouldn't be acceptable for anybody in public service, regardless of your party. So, like, I've actually purposely been trying to keep it sort of less partisan than a lot of other issues.
We have a couple of letters on the Supreme Court. All the suggestions about importance of ethics rules in government are applicable unless you're a justice of the Supreme Court. Why doesn't it start there?
I mean, the levels of vetting that you have to go through to become a Supreme Court justice, as imperfect as they are intense. And I think what people are focused on is once somebody's appointed to a position on the Supreme Court, then sometimes in the cases of certain justices, it takes decades to uncover all the things that they were able to keep quiet or they developed after they achieved that seat of power.
It's like a really long road trip in an RV.
Yeah, right. Well, because it's a lifetime appointment. So until that changes, I mean, I think you have to like really, really, really do something really bad. I haven't looked up what it takes to get removed from the Supreme Court, but, you know, like...
You have to be impeached.
Like, so, you know, yeah. But the process for that even is so... it
but,
takes
but
something...
But what's amazing
very...
is we haven't hit it yet.
Oh, no. We're
it's just kid stuff.
It's a race to the bottom.
Alice writes, they said Supreme Court ruling on bribes versus gratuities. They said bribes beforehand are not okay, but rewards / gratuities afterwards are. So how does this latest decision apply in the Linda Sun situation?
So, I mean, it's the acceptance of gifts. I mean, you're not supposed to accept gifts and... anything like gifts and honoraria over a certain amount are not acceptable. Under that certain amount of need to be reported, and in part, none of this was reported. And that is one of the strengths of having an ethics disclosure, is that it doesn't prevent somebody from doing something potentially illegal or immoral. What it does is it gives a mechanism to go back and enforce afterwards.
Hmm.
Well, the allegations, so the indictment was unsealed yesterday. So that's probably where the emails came from, too. But the indictment alleges visa fraud, non-citizen smuggling, and money laundering conspiracy. So I think the question is which facts support those allegations, actually. So it's interesting that those are the allegations, because whatever facts they have don't fit neatly into other categories.
Well, they also made it look like they were hiding something by not paying taxes on that money and by not reporting it on your ethics form. That's a huge red flag.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the violation, I believe, of the Foreign Agents Registration Act, in all likelihood. Because the only formal fraud charge is a immigration fraud allegation.
And this is an interesting approach, but it's not an unusual approach. So if you think about it, a lot of times, like going after organized crime leadership, the feeling is, you know, that they're guilty of lots of terrible things, you know, murder and human trafficking and things like that. But then what they're charged with is something as benign as non-payment of taxes.
Right.
And I always find it fascinating at DHS when you look at some of the task forces that in order to be able to get just the wheels of justice moving, it didn't come from, you know, the FBI or DHS. It came from Treasury in the form of IRS enforcement. And that was the mechanism that could then be used to go get warrants and perform searches. And so when you're thinking about sort of cross jurisdictional, cross agency teams, having somebody from the IRS was always something that was viewed as it's a pretty serious case.
Well, and it's interesting that both cases are in the Eastern District, New York, the Sun case and George Santos, who pled guilty to wire fraud and aggravated identity theft just a month ago, 2 weeks ago. So the Eastern District's been busy.
Hmm. Yeah.
But when they charge, they make sure that they're charging for what they can prove.
We got this from Adam, who says, hearing about how China and others manipulate the U.S. brings to mind how it is sometimes the things that make our culture great, like diversity and free exchange of ideas, are also vulnerabilities which can be exploited, similar to interpersonal dynamics in the dating scene. Anyway, a little restraint and self-reflection goes a long way to temper leading with one's strengths and confirmation biases. And maybe our cultural responsibility toward national security is to look for the opposite reaction of our accustomed way of acting.
Yeah, I also think that, and we've talked about it before on the show, that we're in a very interesting time where how society is taking in information is so fundamentally different. And I'm not sure that... the differences in the generations is really understood. So how I get information is I think so fundamentally different than how my kids get information, which I think would be completely different than how, Sarah, your kids are taking in information. So it's the idea of how are we getting our news? How are we becoming informed? How can people influence us? And I think as a country, we're really struggling with that. And I think we see that with X. We see it with Instagram, Snapchat. I mean, all of these are something that we're going to continue to struggle with because the idea of what is fair and truthful is certainly a matter of great debate right now.
JP, we just have about a minute and a half before we have to go to a break. But how do you think the Hochul administration and the governor herself handles this?
I'll be honest. I don't love the quote of like Sarah said. You know, it's not the best quote to say. I am furious and I'm outraged and absolutely shocked at how brazen her behavior was. But that is what she went out and said on WNYC yesterday. That's the message she wanted to communicate to the public and to voters. The governor currently suffers from relatively low approval ratings. This will not help those approval ratings. But do I see this as an ongoing story going into November? I don't. I can't imagine that we're going to see a lot more headlines about this between now and November. Now, if Linda's son is brought into court between now and then, of course, we'll see some headlines. But I don't see this as something that's going to affect the congressional races and how Vice President Harris and Donald Trump perform in the state. That is really what Governor Hochul has set herself up to be a measuring stick this November politically, is how the state performs in terms of flipping the five or six competitive congressional seats that are currently held by Republicans to Democrats. That's something that she's focused on. I could be wrong, but I see this story going away in a couple days.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll take it away, the story, and we'll be...
We'll talk about something else.
We're going to talk about something else. Other than that. We have other stories. We'll just move it right on. We'll do that, and we'll be back right after this. Great music this morning. Just want to shout this out. The Beths are playing at the Bearsville Theater on September 6th. And I believe the show is sold out. So, sorry. We just thought it was a good opportunity to play their music, which is fantastic. A New Zealand indie rock band and really good stuff. So we were all saying in the break, very Cranberries-like. Good stuff. The Beths playing Bearsville Theater, and you can see the playlist. And all you have to do is go to wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org/roundtable. All right, so it is time to move on to other topics. And we, again, welcome you and your thoughts. Panel at wamc.org. Want to talk about the ceasefire push as U.S. readies a last ceasefire push. Benjamin Netanyahu digs in on border demands as he fights for his political survival. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's insistence on keeping troops on a narrow strip of land along the Gaza-Egypt border has become the main obstacle to a ceasefire and hostage release agreement with Hamas. That, according to current and former officials from mediating countries. After many months of inconclusive talks, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris discussed with advisors on Monday how to move forward with a final, quote, take it or leave it proposal to present to Israel and Hamas, potentially as soon as later this week. For the families of Israeli hostages still hoping to bring their loved ones home alive, and for the more than 2 million Palestinians in Gaza grappling with displacement, hunger, disease, and Israeli bombardment, the stakes have never been higher and the outlook never bleaker. The Washington Post spoke with 9 current and former officials in countries involved in the talks, and they expressed mounting frustration over the lack of progress and deepening pessimism about the prospects for a deal. Most spoke on the condition of anonymity. That from the Washington Post. Bob.
So I will echo that sort of sense of pessimism. I'll put it out there because I can't be anonymous. I'm concerned that because of the makeup of Netanyahu's government, that he's pulled too far to the right. And when you think about his own legal jeopardy, that is now clouding what I think is a step that should have already been taken, and that is a ceasefire in a redrawing. The push for, I think it was the Philadelphia corridor. For those of you that it is not familiar, it's the boundary between Egypt and Gaza. So if you think about the strip of land between the two, and Israel's position is that it needs to be secured by Israel because that's where arms have been flowing in to Gaza and Hamas, which helped create the whole issues around the October 7th event. What it does, though, is by demanding Israel's presence there, it pokes at Egypt, who has been, in my mind, sort of key to at least multiple decades of peace between Israel and their neighbors. And as much as there are issues in my mind with the government of Egypt, they have held true to the accords that they signed. But by saying basically, we don't trust you, we want to be there, it's definitely a poke in the eye and helps derail the efforts for ceasefire. There's 97 hostages still being held. I have no idea what, you know, whether they are still alive or not, but we know that there are 97 hostages who are unaccounted for from the event. And it seems like neither side really is interested in ending the conflict and in dealing with the suffering. And I say neither side because I think Netanyahu owns a lot of this, and I certainly think Hamas continues to own a lot of this, especially if you looked at comments coming out of some of their spokesmen yesterday, where they again threatened to send hostages home in coffins, which I thought, when you're making comments like that, you're really not interested in peace. A couple elements that I will toss in, one is that it can't be, you know, again, it all comes back to the election. We're with 9 weeks of right. Of the election. Certainly the events in Israel and Gaza could play a key role in the election, and Netanyahu knows that. I had another point, and it is now gone. I talked about Netanyahu's own election, but the feeling is that there are a lot of people who are striving to come up with a ceasefire and a more permanent peace accord, but when the two main players just don't seem to want to play ball, it's impossible to get there.
Well, and not to bring this back to corruption and Menendez in particular, but folks might remember that Menendez was just convicted in part for meeting with Egyptian intelligence officials and softening his position toward that country as he speeded its access to millions of dollars in U.S. military aid. So open question how long the United States was complicit in some of the transactions that you were talking about in terms of what ultimately destabilize the region to the point that it's at now.
I'm not optimistic for a deal either between Israel and Hamas. Bob, you said it really well.
Thank you. The other element, Joe, that I mean we should be cognizant of is that the street protests. I'm interested to see how sustainable they are, but there's a level of grief and outrage in Israel right now that feels unprecedented in this event. And again, it goes back to the killing of six of the hostages over the weekend. There's a lot going on. So it's not only our election, it's the Israeli election, but then there's also where in Israel society are they at a tipping point where they are going to force a break in the ruling coalition in order to change government in order to bring peace? And I think that's a little bit of a harder road to hoe.
Anybody else on this? All right. Couple letters. We go to Jared, who says Gaza has already been reduced to rubble, yet Hamas still remains. After almost a year of fighting, it's obvious that as long as the people of Palestine are being mercilessly slaughtered, that there will be no shortage of people looking to join the resistance to Israel, no matter what name you give it.
And Joe, I think it's important to point out that the IDF, the Israel military, has come out and they've said publicly that Netanyahu's policy of complete elimination of Hamas is not doable. So you have your politicians in making statements, and you have your military saying we can't do it. And in fact, when you look at the position on the Philadelphia corridor situation, while the cabinet voted in support of that, their Minister of Defense opposed it. So I mean, you do see sort of these two divergent issues. But when your military is saying we can't do it, and Netanyahu is saying the only way we're going to have peace is if this happens, then basically there is no peace.
So just to change the subject slightly, and another aspect to this story is we are into the fall. Colleges have reopened, and there is a New York Times On Politics newsletter that was published asking the question, will the college protests matter in November? Republicans tied campus unrest to their party platform, but the intensity may have fizzled. Campus protests over, this is from Alan Blinder. Campus protests over the war in Gaza made headlines last school year, helping topple college presidents and giving Republicans an opening to portray Democrats as weak and accuse academics of doing too little to stop anti-Semitism. That has injected back-to-school season with a little more political tension than usual. Republicans pledge in their party platform to make campuses, quote, safe and patriotic again. And they may be hoping that new scenes of chaos on campus can help them blunt Democratic momentum after a summer of political upheaval. It is far from clear, however, that protests will return this fall with the same intensity of the spring, or how much attention voters will pay if they do. This is, and again, Blinder says, I'm taking a look at why this fall might feel different from the last academic year and why political strategists on both sides of the partisan divide doubt that protests and the Republican attacks on universities that have come with them will significantly sway voters. Some of the things that he mentions in this is that it is a new semester, so a lot of the protests have lost much of their momentum, especially during the summer break, and campuses may not feel quite the same to a returning student activist for other reasons as well. There's just a natural turnover of students. Also, doubts on both sides. If university leaders get their wish for a more muted protest season, Republicans will have fewer chances to argue to voters, most of whom have already said they have higher priorities than college demonstrations, that the nation's campuses have become hotbeds of havoc. Great band, by the way. Hotbeds of havoc? Oh, my God. So good. And polling from the spring suggested that despite the protests, the war in Gaza was not actually a top priority for young college-aged voters. Sarah. It's a perfect answer to it. That's an interviewer's dream. Ask a question, the first response, ugh.
This is, I sit on a campus of higher education. It's not it's not an undergraduate campus. It's a professional school. And part of what we teach lawyers about is the First Amendment, the free speech that we have, time, place, and manner restrictions, the role of civil disobedience, and all of these sort of 400-level college classes, right, that are sort of the building blocks of some of your law school constitutional law classes, specifically the First Amendment and related cases. People want to come down on protesters when they lack power. College students inherently are in a hierarchical disadvantage. I agree with one piece of this blend of analysis, and that is that college protests should not be high on the list of concerns in terms of national security or the police state. They are certainly important when you think about younger voter-aged citizens.
Right.
and citizen responsibility to each other. It is of course a concern for the administrations at these undergraduate campuses to make sure that they're building a student body that cares about each other and is considerate of each other's point of view. The only way to make your one of many effective ways to make your point of view known is protest. Like that, we can't eliminate it because it's uncomfortable or difficult or something that needs to be managed and takes some time. But it's not, I really bristle at the idea that college students protesting is a policing issue or an issue of national
security. What about when they
break
laws?
Well, it depends on what laws you mean. Like if it's trespass.
Or breaking
what type of trespass?
Well, yeah, like if they go and break windows and go into an administration building, then that is a police issue, right?
Well, it is potentially. It depends on how the campus wants to handle it, right? And there are different layers of security. There's campus security. There's city police. There's county. There's state and federal. There are multiple layers of policing. But, you know, why would that be taken more seriously than, for example, a sexual assault allegation, which on college campuses have historically regularly been underplayed and downplayed by law enforcement officials and people in power in the administration because it seems like an easier target and not gendered, right? So gender-based violence is subordinated in the hierarchy of policing concerns as a trend nationally. So I just get frustrated by the inherent cognitive dissonance when it comes to protesters vis-a-vis other types of manageable issues on college campuses.
I don't think it's going to be a big issue in the presidential election unless, you know, as we lead up to the week or 10 days before the election, before the voting or as the voting is happening, that story itself, the election, will be certainly the top story. What is on the other side of the front pages that day? Is it that there is a big flare up in the Middle East and that there are mass protests on college campuses? Then that can certainly shade the election. But it's hard to know what is going to be, or it's impossible to know what is going to be on the front pages other than the presidential election leading up to it. But you could see, international events flare up in the days leading up to the election. Then I think it could become a factor.
Also, protest is patriotic. So this idea of make campuses patriotic again just really starts to sound a lot like North Korea and other places that restrict speech. We're not anywhere close to that, but it's just it's incongruent with the idea of American democracy to say, you know, to be patriotic you have to be quiet.
Well, it's become a GOP talking point too, right? That, you know, again, it's the academic elites, it's the spoiled college kids, it's sort of running that whole perspective. And think about the earlier conversation we had about the complexities of the whole situation in Gaza, and there is enough blame between Netanyahu and Hamas to go around. I mean, but there's not a clear cut position. I don't think it's going to be as big an issue on campuses unless, frankly, it's funded. And if I start to see well-organized, large-scale events, I mean, the cynical side of me was saying, who's funding, you know, where is that money coming from?
Well, it's not going to pay their student loans.
No.
We know that. Well, and I just have to, here's another, it's college football season.
Yes.
You can probably scan through your memory banks and think of way more violent reactions to wins and losses to college football games than college protests in the last 30 years. Hands down. More flipped over vehicles, things on fire.
Yeah.
And there aren't as many pearl clutching articles written about that. And some people get charged. A lot of people don't.
It's also, if we're going to condemn the protests, then I expect a stronger level of condemnation for January 6th. Why is January 6th a patriotic event? But whether you agree with it or not, students voicing legally their protests on campus. You know, it's just, I mean, it's just that there's just a
well,
level.
At least Stefanik would give you an entire list.
Well, I would welcome her on the show. There's an open seat. Come on down, Elise. I'd love to see you here.
It is something that the Republicans will certainly try to amplify going into November, the fact that three top university presidents have been either forced to resign or fired by their boards because of anti-Semitism on campus. And that is something that they will use to their advantage. I think that images of the protests, when you see the kids on the news and you overwhelmingly see not the peaceful protests where people are exercising their rights, but you see people breaking windows and wearing keffiyehs and waving Palestinian flags, that is, if you look at how that affects the electorate, I would say it favors Republicans.
Absolutely.
Do I think that it's going to be the top issue that decides the election? Absolutely not.
No. Right. And I don't mean to say anything that would condone anti-Semitic activity on these campuses. There is, but that's a more granular level than the news covers. That's a more granular level than I think the police state should be involved in. And that is definitely an issue for campus administrators to think through and create learning environments that cultivate a respectful and model a respectful exchange and to identify places where people can push the envelope and experiment with the different ways to express themselves as individuals and groups in a learning environment.
And I will go back, and we've said it before on the show, and I know Libby has said it as well. It's not being, you know, you can support Israel, the right to a Jewish state, but question Netanyahu's policies. So questioning Netanyahu's policies isn't necessarily anti-Semitism. With that said, with the protesters, you know, part of, Sarah, what you're saying I think is really important is that we continue to try to educate so that when they're mouthing slogans from Hamas, they understand what the slogans really mean. Because, you know, when you mouth the motto about from the river to the sea, that you're advocating genocide. So there's a lot of education that needs to go on. I think we're in that weird window of, if you're going to start to really influence the election, you got about 5 weeks, 4 weeks to, you know, 3 weeks even maybe to make a difference in people's perception.
Right.
And I think what happens next Tuesday night is by far the most important trigger for the election.
The debate. Real quick, Dwight writes to us and says, I was offended by Mr. Netanyahu criticizing our campus students for protesting the excessive killing of Palestinians. For him to come to our country and criticize our youth, who are the conscience of our country, expressing their beliefs based on their life experience, was out of line.
That's, and let's remember that Netanyahu has got, you know, he undermined, I think, both Obama when he was president, and I think he's undermined Biden as president.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up with our great group this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back. Hard to interrupt that.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Roundtable program, and thank you very much for being with us. Sarah Rogerson, Bob Griffin, J.P. Miller making up the group. We just have about 15 minutes together before we have to break for this morning, but we certainly thank you, and we welcome you if you would like to join us in these last moments of us being together. I would like to go to the topic of immigration, which means, hey, Sarah, you need to talk. fascinating story I've been reading. There were several reports last night I was reading. I found an article in The Guardian that I thought best explained
what was going on. But Canada is taking steps, both official and unofficial, to curb the number of people coming to the country, highlighting the way in which immigration has become a political flashpoint ahead of a federal election. According to figures obtained by Reuters, the ratio of refused visitor visa applications to approved ones was higher in recent months than at any point since the height of the pandemic. Immigration officials rejected more applications than they approved in January, February, May, and June. At the same time, the number of approved study and work permits dropped, and in July, Canada refused entry to nearly 6,000 foreign travelers, including students, workers, and tourists, the most since at least January of 2019. Reuters reported the shift appears to be informal and not dictated by a change in policy. So, just a coincidence?
Well, no. Anytime immigration changes happen, it's often political, going back to the theme for today. Trudeau is facing this. I was a French major. I'm going to try. Pierre Poilievre. Maybe, is the conservative.
I found that impressive.
Yeah, great.
the conservative potential challenger to Justin Trudeau. And I started looking into this before I saw the immigration story because of the hockey story that unfolded this weekend, the tragic deaths of Johnny Gaudreau and his brother over the weekend. Both Trudeau and his potential challenger, issued statements. And I thought that was odd. But it's hockey and it's Canada, so it made sense in that context. But then when I read the immigration story, you know, this is what sitting government leaders do when they're facing challenges from conservative, ultra-conservative, or, you know, hard-right challengers who have made their restrictionist positions known on the issue of immigration. They meet them where the voter base is at in order to retain power under the guise of, well, we'll fix it later when we win re-election. But ultimately, they don't. So it's like a Lucy in the football situation every single time, because what happens is immigrants become the political football with which government leaders tinker around the edges to either typically to make things more restrictionist, to pacify conservative centrist voters in order to you know, stay where they are, stay in power. Maybe that's just a deeply cynical read, but I don't think it's wrong.
I don't think it's deeply cynical. I think it goes to show that I don't think any nation is getting their immigration policy correct right now. I mean, whether it's Canada, whether it's France, whether it's England, whether, you know, the United Kingdom, whether it's the United States, I'm not sure anybody has figured out what the new norm is in immigration. I'll go back and keep repeating, though, when you look at birth rates and you look at the demands that we have for employment and employment needs, we and Canada can't survive without immigration. So to understand that while it may be a feel-good, knee-jerk reaction that, you know, oh, we're going to close the borders, we're going to protect jobs for Canada, at the same time, you're creating a secondary and tertiary effect down the road in your employment and services that is going to be really difficult to fix. And I know we're facing that here in this country as well.
Yeah, what I see in Canada is anti-immigrant sentiment, and we're seeing that more and more in the United States. Even Kamala Harris, one of her first television ads is called Tougher, and it says, you know, as vice president, Kamala Harris backed the toughest border control bill in decades. As president, she will hire thousands more border agents and crack down on human trafficking and fentanyl. And I remember seeing that Kamala Harris ad, and I said, this looks like a Republican ad. This looks like a Trump ad, you know, that, and she's going to be the tough one on the border. And so I think not just the Republicans, but the Democrats realize that this is a big issue. You see it in New York City with very progressive members of the New York City Council who are, you know, they want to have a sanctuary city in New York City. But then when you try to bring an immigrant center to their district, they're out there fighting, no, not in our district. This just isn't quite the place for it. And that's just, you know, what you see it in Europe, you see it in Canada, and you certainly see it in the United States.
I would say that some of the objections by the progressives in New York City, though, are less about the not in my backyard situation or anti-immigrant sentiment and more about the mismanagement of that whole situation by the mayor. Eric Adams has completely mismanaged that entire situation, and there are very few elected officials who feel confident in his plan for the resettlement and management of people being brought to New York State.
Well, no council members support bringing those centers to their own district. And where are those centers going to? They're not going to the wealthy parts. They're not going to Manhattan. They're going to overwhelmingly black and brown communities in the Bronx and Brooklyn. And those council members and those elected officials in those communities do not support them being in those communities.
Yeah, we have to figure it out. People move. People are going to keep moving, and people are going to move at an increased pace. We live in, currently, the upstate New Yorkers live in a climate haven. We are going to see a lot of people coming to New York State for lots of different reasons, including American citizens who no longer have a habitable place to live. And that's not like 100 years from now. That's closer than everyone realizes. So it's been time. It's long past time to get a grip at the federal, state, and hyperlocal level about the fact that people move. Wherever they're from, they move for all kinds of reasons. And how to manage that is an essential government function. And although Congress has ultimate say in that sphere of influence, there's also what's happening state to state and even border state to border state. I mean, we're used to seeing the news stories about the southern border. The northern border is very rarely covered and has very rarely been controversial, to the point where there were often informal border crossings in the North Country where Canadian officials would sort of turn a blind eye to avoid certain international arrangements around repatriation. So what we're seeing is a trend toward blaming others for the problems that we're creating ourselves.
It's also an issue of service. And I think the situation, like if you look at the situation in Chicago, where there were protests about placement of immigration support services, it is the perception that government is giving them, the immigrants, services that the locals are not being given. And I think we've talked
and
about
money.
In money. And you know, it's unfortunate because I think there's some quick fixes we could do to our immigration laws that would make things a lot more palatable, like allowing people to work. There's a gap that we impose on immigrants that will not allow them to get legal employment, and then we wonder why they need services, because, well, everybody, they still need to eat and sleep somewhere. Is it 60? How long is it, Sarah? Is it 60 days? Is it?
It's about 6 months, and it depends on it depends on a lot of different factors, and then there's the processing times.
Right. So I mean, a lot of this is to the making. It's also interesting, you know, JP, that Trump is starting to whine that Harris is stealing his policies. No, she isn't. I heard him, I think it was yesterday or one day earlier in this week, of, oh, you know, she's just copying my policies.
Well, I do think that you'll see in the presidential debate, she will make the case that she is going to be tougher on the border than Donald Trump, which is a significant change from what you heard, for instance, Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden say against Trump. She, you know, the polling shows in these swing states, it's very unpopular, and you're going to see her make the case she's the tough one on the border.
Obama was.
Yeah.
He was called deporter-in-chief for a reason. That's statistically provable.
Oh, the debate.
But it's how, right? Like, Obama's proclamation was, I'm going after people who actually broke laws in this country. That's different than Trump, who is openly xenophobic and racist.
And why, and I'm taking full responsibility for this, by the way, but why do, I'm going to say we, to make myself feel better, but why do we have little memory of that?
For the same reason why, you know, a week from now, we're going to have to re-educate people about 9/11. I mean, yeah.
I have a different answer to that. It's in part because the Republicans have skewed the narrative, and in part because the Democrats don't gain by poking at elements of their base by reminding them that they were actually very strict.
Yeah, no, it's all right. It's all temporal. It depends on what message needs to be heard at what time in order to gain the largest number of percentage points in the polls, which, even though they're not supposed to be, have become somewhat predictive of human behavior in elections.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to everyone for being with us this morning. Thank you for your letters. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a part of the program. Of the panel part, we will continue the show as we move through till noon this morning. J.P. Miller, Bob Griffin, and Sarah Rogerson, my thanks to all of you for being here. Great pleasure, as always. We will be back after the short break.